Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, for several years, cryptocurrencies were considered fringe investments on Wall Street. But this week, a massive intraday plunge in Bitcoin had some serious ripple effects on the stock market. Is this type of contagion the new abnormal for markets? We'll get into it with a veteran market strategist, and we'll also get his take on what type of stocks look attractive these days in this strange new world of risk-taking that we're in. But first, Charlie Pellett, tell us who this week's mystery co-host is.
This week's mystery co-host is Vildana Heyrich. Vildana is a cross-asset reporter for Bloomberg in New York, and she owns a rescue cat from Kuwait. Her hobbies include running marathons, watching videos about grammar, and looking for typos in stories that Mike Regan has already edited.
That's all true, Vildana, correct? My favorite fun Vildana fact is the cat from Kuwait. I need to hear that story. How did you rescue a cat from Kuwait?
Oh, it's a state secret. I can't tell you. Okay. She is a rescue from Kuwait. We actually worked with a small organization, and there's a woman who works for one of the bigger airlines, and she does a lot of U.S. to Mideast trips, and she puts them on the plane, basically, and brings them in. And that's how my sister got her cat. That's how I got my cat. So
that's pretty good. Katie Greifeld had a cat delivered via plane in some mysterious circumstance. Cat people are weird. I don't know. That's not how we get dogs. No one would allow my dog on a plane, I guess, is part of the thing. But
it's because anyway, we love them so much.
I guess so. That's it. But Vildana, I'm very excited for this week's guest. As you know, I've been doing this job a few years. Our guest has been doing it for his job for a few years, and we've never actually met. So I thank you for putting us all together this week. I will warn you, though, Vildana, our guest is from Boston, and he's got a great reputation as a nice guy, but there's always a risk with people from Boston at this time of year. And that's all they really want to talk about is the Red Sox. So I think we'll allow that. I don't know if some of our New York-based listeners will care for that, but I'll allow a little Red Sox talk. I'm from Philly. It doesn't bother me that much. But I need you, if he starts talking about the Celtics, I need you to cut him off.
No problem.
Instantly.
Okay. I'll play referee.
All right.
If you hear the names Kemba Walker or Jason Tatum, just hit that mute button on him instantly, all right? I'll let him talk about Taco Fall. I like that guy. That's my favorite Celtic. Taco Fall is the only person I've ever seen dunk a basketball without leaving his feet. So that's made him one of my favorite players of all time. But let's bring him into the show here. He is the chief market strategist at National Securities. His name is Art Hogan. Art, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, Art. And, you know, I do want to get into that idea of the cryptocurrency contagion, but I was reading your bio. Vildana sent over your bio. And one thing jumped out at me that I find really interesting, and that's you started off your career on the floor of the Boston stock market, Boston Stock Exchange, rather. And I find that interesting because when I started at Bloomberg just years ago, it was right when the computerization of markets was in full swing and all these regional exchanges were kind of getting swallowed up by the bigger players. I think it was NASDAQ that bought Boston. But I've always been curious. I never quite wrapped my head around sort of what the distinction was between these regional exchanges. I mean, obviously, different type of clam chowder served in Boston than New York Exchange. But I'm curious, like, what was the scene like at the Boston Stock Exchange? I'm picturing maybe, is it the type of thing where New England companies would perhaps have a little bit more liquidity on an exchange like that? What was the purpose of these regional exchanges like Boston? And kind of what was it like working there?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And your concept of what a regional exchange is a very popular misconception, right? So regional exchanges were trading just about everything that was traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And at the time, the American Stock Exchange. And what they really were was a national market system. So there was seven regional exchanges, two on the West Coast, one in Los Angeles, one in San Francisco. There's one in Chicago, the Midwest Stock Exchange, which was the largest. Philadelphia had its own exchange, and Boston had one of exchanges. So they were well over 100 years old by the time I got there, and they were really competition for the New York Stock Exchange. So think about it like this. The New York Stock Exchange would do about 80% of the listed volume, and the regionals would do about 20%.
That's interesting. And would it be the type of thing where, you know, say a firm like Fidelity would do more trading on Boston than it would in New York, you know, a Boston area firm?
That was certainly the case, at least for me. I worked for Fidelity, so I was actually a Fidelity employee and a floor broker on the exchange. And just to give you a sense of the time that I was there for the October crash in 1987, where the market went down 22.6% in a day. To put some context around that, that would be about 7,700 points for the Dow to go down on a given day, like today. So it was a, some pretty crazy times. And electronic trading really was at its infancy. So we were actually writing tickets and ripping things up. And there was a mess on the floor. And that October Monday of 1987, we were up to our knees in paper because it was just the craziest day anybody had ever seen.
All right, let's get into that idea of crypto. Speaking of crazy things, first of all, am I nuts to think that plunge in Bitcoin did have some contagion in the stock market? I'm talking beyond sort of the names that are exposed to crypto, like Tesla and MicroStrategy and those type of stocks. It felt to me like it dragged the whole market down. Is that your sense too?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of people that are really coming across that concept and saying, hey, you know, we're seeing cryptocurrencies down some 30% in a single day and the market's down too. There must be some correlation. So the obvious correlations are the things you just mentioned, the things that are directly tied and correlated to cryptocurrencies. But I think in a real sense, I step back and say, what's happened in the second quarter? And I would say that we've removed a lot of speculative excesses in different asset classes. So for example, SPACs, which were all the rage in the first quarter, have really fallen upon hard times in the second quarter, right? We had a record number of SPACs last year. And in the first quarter, we beat that record. And all of a sudden, supply had really swamped demand. So a lot of those SPACs that came out and came public have pulled back significantly. We saw the same thing in electronic vehicle related stocks. We've certainly seen that over the last 3 days in crypto. So I think it's much more of a risk off and remove some speculative excesses and less of a correlation where people are looking at this and saying, if people are selling Bitcoin, they must be selling the S&P 500.
Well, Art, can I actually ask you to sort of help define what is going on with markets right now? Because when we think back to last year, it was really easy to see who was leading markets. It was tech up until November, right? When you had some of the vaccine announcements. And then even after that, you sort of had some clear and delineated market leadership. And I feel like over the last couple of weeks, the narrative has been really difficult to define, to say the least, besides everything else that's sort of going on a day-to-day basis. But so can you help us make sense of how we even describe what is going on with markets?
I think if we back the lens up a little bit and say what happened in 2020 that's not happening in 21 is a pretty good way to give a snapshot of what we've seen this year so far. So 2020 was all about what it was that was helping us get through a pandemic, everything that helped us work from home, like the Zoom app that we're on right now, like all the information technology that made our lives easier and possible, the work from home crowd that the pandemic darlings were the rage. And they were until about Labor Day. And around Labor Day and things really getting stretched, the relative strength index for the Nasdaq Composite and Nasdaq 100 had gotten to significantly overbought. And we saw a significant rotation. We saw a pretty good drawdown in the NASDAQ, the better part of 9% after Labor Day, and a rotation into economically sensitive cyclicals, which had largely been ignored. And that was really the beginning of that reopening trade. So people decided that we need to start selling those things that have been working and gotten to, you know, excessive valuations towards the end of the year. And that proceeded to continue that rotation all the way into the first quarter of this year. So we came into the first quarter of this year and that rotation was pretty strong. You saw a pretty good ramp up in economically sensitive cyclicals, everything from industrials to financials and energy, which is the best performing sector in the S&P 500 right now. And the money was coming from the selling of technology, for example, but a lot of the other pandemic darlings. So I think that that sort of set the table for both of those trades to get stretched in the first quarter. And what we've seen since the second quarter began is a back and forth rotation based on how far we oversold technology and how far we've overbought some of the cyclicals. I think the pandemic darlings got oversold, and I think that some of the cyclicals have been overbought. So we keep going back and forth on a week-by-week basis where that rotation reverses itself, and I think that's where we're going to be for most of the summer.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know, just to get back a little bit to that relationship between crypto and the equity markets, to me, I've always thought of it as crypto as kind of almost like a safety valve for this sort of over excessive risk taking and sort of exuberant sentiment out there, especially with all the liquidity we have in the markets right now. And how that, you know, is a nice little safety valve for the stock market. You know, it perhaps, you know, can siphon off some of that froth that otherwise would have, you know, been pumped directly into the stock market, you know, as the case was perhaps in the dot-com era, where all the speculation and all that euphoria was focused, you know, right on the equities and all the IPOs coming out. But I do wonder, you know, when we look at, and not just Bitcoin. I mean, obviously, Ethereum is the hot topic these days. And Bitcoin and Ethereum also being, you know, sort of the blue chips of the crypto world right now. But when you go further down the ladder to, say, Dogecoin or some of these ridiculous meme coins, the names of which I can't even say on a family podcast like this. And you watch this paper wealth be vaporized to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars in a matter of hours. I find that to be a risky, dangerous thing. But I'm curious how you sort of think of that interplay between, you know, the animal spirits and the euphoria chasing the get rich quick type of trades in crypto. Is that ultimately a healthy thing for the stock market, or could it sort of ricochet back and be a bad thing?
Well, I think that's an interesting way to set that up, Mike. And I think that when you sort of hearken back to, you know, 98, 99, 2000, we had hundreds of companies that put .com at the end of their title, went public, and, you know, oftentimes were up 100% on the first day of trading. And lo and behold, as 2000 turned into 2001, a lot of those companies disappeared. Now we have hundreds of cryptocurrencies that have exploded in value. And to your point, is that a safety valve of speculative money finding a place other than the stock market? For sure. I think that's certainly the case. I think the way to think about crypto in general is the backbone of crypto, obviously, is blockchain. And blockchain is likely to be a more important paradigm for us in the future, very much like the internet's much more important to us than it was in 98, 99. We just don't know who the winners and losers are going to be. And I think it's going to play out in a similar fashion. So we're not going to have hundreds of cryptocurrencies. We'll likely have some winners. I think the basic foundation to that is the technology behind it that will help us transact business in a more efficient and a more efficient way. But in terms of investors, the just your garden variety investor, you have to know this is speculative. And I think that the volatility is a feature. It's not a bug, it's a feature. And we've seen since the start of Bitcoin, it's had at least a half a dozen 50% drawdowns. We just went through another one. So to think about this as a stable asset class is the wrong way to think about it. And if you're going to invest in this, you want to think about something small and money that you would only put in a speculative bucket, something like a 0 to 5%.
And so a lot of times when people are talking about cryptocurrencies and some of the volatility that we see there, they'll tie it back to retail investors either rushing in or getting burned, depending on what's going on. But so how are you and your team thinking about the involvement of the retail investor? Obviously, it's been a really big topic for the past year, but then you sort of see conflicting data points where you might see inflows, for instance, into some retail favorite ETFs, but at the same time, you're seeing waning call option volume. So how are you guys thinking about the involvement of the retail investor?
Yeah, so the involvement of the retail investor in crypto is something we sort of have to keep it at arm's length. We will partner with somebody that runs a fund, but then that fund is going to charge fees, so it's probably not the most efficient way to do this. You know, in terms of overall advice, we make sure people know that it's not for the faint of heart or widows and orphans, and it should be treated as a speculative asset class. So I think in the future, when an ETF is approved, there'll probably be a lot more retail involvement. But again, it should be sized to what you would size any speculative investment towards. And I think that when we think about that, we get questions about it all the time. But I think that what is healthy, and to Mike's point, is the kind of volatility that we've seen this week is a reminder to everybody that it's not going to always just go up and nothing's guaranteed here. And it's likely something you want to be pretty cautious about as you tiptoe into it as an investment.
I tend to think of it as lottery ticket money, stuff you're an amount you're not going to feel a lot of pain if you lose on some losing tickets. But all right, I wanted to talk a little bit about this perennial debate between growth and value, and in this case, the real cyclical parts of the market as the reopening of the economies gets stronger and stronger. I think you've got a pretty interesting approach. You're almost sort of the neutral Switzerland in this debate, recommending a kind of a barbell approach where you have growth on one side of the barbell and more cyclical stock exposure on the other side. Why don't you unpack that for us a little bit? Sort of what kind of sectors, what kind of names are you looking at on both ends of that barbell?
Yeah, so our approach really is a barbell approach that has growth on one side and cyclicality on the other. And we want you to have that approach because we don't think it's going to be a binary investment climate ever, right? So we don't think it's only going to be growth and not value. And when we think about value, we think about cyclicality, especially in a reopening economy. So if you have balance where you say, okay, what are the three themes I can really get my head wrapped around in growth? And we've thrown out cloud computing, cloud security, and 5G as thematics that we like and express those opinions that manifest exposure to those themes. And then on the other side of that, look at what's going to work in cyclicality. So we've selected materials, industrials, and financials. A lot of our investors have swapped out materials for energy and happily. But what you have to do, though, is really important is every 2 months to keep that barbell balanced, you have to sell the winners and buy some of your losers. So in February was one of the first times in three rotations where we actually had to sell some of our cyclicality and put more money into the growth. And that leveled the bar back out. So you have equal exposure, you have a 50-50 exposure. And if you had done that for all of 2020, you would have outperformed the S&P 500 by almost 500 basis points, about 483 basis points. And we think the same thing is going to be true this year. And I think that helps you navigate these rotational markets where we have where growth is back, people are buying the growth names again, or wait a minute, they're back to cyclicality. We're, jumping into the financials. The industrials are doing great. And that gives you some balance. And if you set the timer so you know that you have to rebalance on a 2 month basis, you don't have to make that emotional decision to say, I really don't want to sell my winners and buy some of my losers. It forces your hand and keeps you in a diversified portfolio.
And of course, the other perennial, the new perennial debate is inflation, of course. And I know in your recent notes, you've written about some of your thoughts there, saying inflationary pressures will be more temporary. So I'm hoping you can sort of bring that into the conversation and how you're thinking about inflationary pressures. And is it your view that even if we do see some inflation, stocks can still continue to do well?
So one of the concerns that you have is about inflation is margin pressure, right? Do you get margin pressure if your input costs start rising, but you're not able to pass that increased cost of goods sold onto the consumer? And through the first quarter earnings season, we've already heard from some of those companies that have said, clearly stated, we need to raise prices. Some of the inflationary pressures we think are going to be temporary because there's an old saying that nothing fixes high prices like high prices, and you get a supply response. So we're starting to see that a bit as capacity utilization has gone up in sawmills. So lumber prices have come down about 27-28% over the course of a week. I think that's healthy. I think the same thing will be true in energy prices as more production comes online, whether that comes from Iran sanctions coming off or OPEC plus increasing output quotas, which they're doing in North America, going from 11 million barrels a day to 13 million barrels a day. I think that supply response helps push down on some of those inflationary pressures. So that's why we think some of it's going to be temporary. I think the Fed feels that way as well, and they're willing to be asymmetric on their inflation target. Their target has been their target of 2% PCE hasn't been met in 10 years. They're willing to let inflation run a bit hotter unless and until we get to substantial economic progress towards full employment. So I think that a combination of a Fed that's going to be patient with a little hotter inflation, which we've seen some reports of, and just the economics of supply and demand, seeing a supply response come back into the marketplace. So right now we're in a world where aggregate demand is outstripping aggregate supply. I think the supply response gets us to a place where a lot of that gets neutralized. And that's not going to happen right away. We'll probably have inflation running hot throughout the balance of this year, but I don't think it gets hotter. I think it plateaus. And I think as we enter the first quarter of next year, prices start to come in.
You know, Art, I know you have a year-end target for the S&P of about 4,300, if I'm not mistaken. That's not too far from where we are now. You know, I'm looking at my screen. It's probably about 3% and change away. So I'm curious how you're thinking about that. You know, is it the potential that maybe you'll even raise that? Or is it a matter of, you know, a lot of people are sort of bracing for the Fed to start thinking about, talking about, thinking about, maybe even whispering and rumors about that dirty word tapering. And you know, a lot of people looking at even possibly as early as the Jackson Hole meeting in August. Is that kind of embedded in that forecast? A little bit of, you know, a hint that the punch bowl will be drained next year in that forecast? Or how are you viewing that at this point?
We put the target out at the beginning of the year. It's about a 15% upside from that point in time. So to your point, we've already captured about 10 or 11% of that. It's predicated on a multiple, the current multiple for the S&P 500, but based on $186 earnings estimate for the S&P 500. Well, that number's gone up already, right? So the 186 that we're factoring that against worked its way higher after the first quarter earnings reporting season. So we'd have to make an adjustment on that on a standstill basis. The estimates for the second quarter and the second half are now higher than they were when we started this. So I think that when you think about what happens when the Fed starts inching towards tapering and getting that message out there, I think they're going to be deliberately cautious about bleeding it into the marketplace. So we don't have that surprise taper that we had in 2013 that caused a much more abrupt sell-off, but it's certainly going to slow things down. And I certainly think that as they start talking about it more and more, people will ascribe a lower multiple to the earnings power of equities, and that will likely temper some of the upside. And I think your timing is probably right. If you start thinking about Jackson Hole being at the end of the summer, and that's been a time frame when central bankers have signaled changes in policy and policy paradigms, that's when quantitative easing was first introduced. So this may be the time that they start talking about tapering and likely don't take action on it until the fourth quarter of this year. I think that's going to give the market plenty of notice. And at the very same time, I think second quarter earnings are still conservative and second half earnings are still conservative because I just don't think we've come close to realizing the explosion of economic activity we're going to see as people get back to their normal lives.
your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
So with the Fed minutes coming out this week and the Fed hinting at the T word, talking about the tapering, if somebody were to ask you about this, how would you recommend investors actually start to prepare for that or position for that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So some of the things we think about in terms of investing to hedge against inflation have a lot to do with what our barbell approach looks like. So the Fed's going to be tapering because the economy is recovering. So all of the economically sensitive cyclicals that we look at will do better, right? In an improving economy that is forcing the Fed to start reducing their monthly purchases of fixed income assets. So that side of the barbell actually will outperform likely things like industrials, materials, financials, energy, and that will likely hedge you a bit. But at the very same time, if you were all in on just cyclicality, you're going to miss what it's going to be a pretty explosive growth in things like 5G and cloud computing and cloud security and the themes that will continue to be evergreen in terms of technology revenue and earnings growth.
You know, Art, we're going to get to the craziest thing soon. And I have high hopes for Vildana here. She's actually what I call our chief crazy things correspondent. So no pressure, Vildana, but the hopes are high for your crazy thing. But Art, before we get to that, a lot of the guests we have on are very macro focused and very hesitant to drop the names of some stocks they like. I've got a feeling you'll be able to hit us with a few names on either side of that barbell that are looking attractive to you right now. Are there any stocks that you could kind of talk about as good buys in your mind right now?
Yeah, a couple of the names that we think about on the growth side and how do you express an opinion in things like 5G or cloud security. We've got Palo Alto Networks on our focus list. We've got Apple Computer on our focus list. One's cloud security. One's clearly a 5G play on our national dividend list. We have Verizon, which is clearly a 5G beneficiary. So those are some of the cyclical names. We have Lam Research also on that list. So I think those are some of the names that when you think about the growth side that actually have earnings. And that's the difference about playing some of these themes, because as interest rates start to go up, that long duration technology play, that really rapid revenue growth, but earnings that are far out in the future are going to be discounted back at a much higher multiple, right? So you're going to, instead of being willing to pay 30 times for that kind of revenue growth, you're likely going to pay 15 or 20 times. So we like those companies that are measured with a price to earnings ratio. And we certainly like the thematics that we're locked into. Those are some of the concepts around that. Over on the side that we sort of consider the economically sensitive cyclical side, JP Morgan is one of the names that certainly feels like as a financial is going to do very well. I think that we think that Visa falls into that category as well in terms of financials. And then when we think about some of the industrials, when we look at industrials and materials, we certainly think that Caterpillar is a great way to think about that. And sort of play that. Now, those are individual names. A lot of our folks that are using the barbell approach will just use the ETF. They'll use the cloud security ETF and pick their favorite one. They'll use the 5G ETF, and that's another way to approach it. So it doesn't have to be picking single stocks. As long as you're expressing the opinion that it's giving you exposure to the right themes and growth, and at the same time, the right themes that you want to be expressing opinions in, on the cyclical side.
5G to me seems like an area that's got a kind of a long runway for, say, a buy and hold type of investor, as opposed to on the other side of the barbell, some of these cyclicals. I feel like there's an expiration date on their outperformance. Is that Does that jibe with what you're thinking?
Yeah, that's probably true, right? So when you think about real long duration thematics, 5G certainly plays into that. We're just scratching the surface of what that's going to look like. So it's, you know, it's probably out in front of us for years, as is cloud security. I mean, we just had another cyber attack, and it's the second major one that we've had this year. So cloud security is always going to continue to be, you know, important to us. But we don't know how high interest rates go. So the financials likely, you know, in an improving economy, both have more demand for the goods and services, but likely will have a lot more net interest margin. So I think that, you know, just rising interest rates help the financials just by turning the lights on. So I think there's some runway on both sides of that, but that's very true. But heaven forbid, if we were able to get an infrastructure bill passed, some of the other industrials, materials, you know, clearly are going to be beneficiaries of that. And again, that's a 6-year plan, right? So to me, I think, you know, there's longevity in a lot of this, but, you know, it's I think one of the ways to protect yourself from any of these things getting too frothy is just that. Every 2 months, you have to recalibrate that. And if any of this has gotten ahead of itself, you're rebalancing into what hasn't been working.
Yeah, that's a great point about the infrastructure plan. That would provide a much longer runway for those names. Great stuff, Art. Let us now go to Vildana's favorite segment, the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
I'm going to save yours for last, Vildana, because I have a feeling you're bringing us something good. And also this way, if we both had the same one, then mine will be first and I win. So
I'm actually hoping to throw you for a loop here. I picked something that I think is very unexpected, and it is not crypto related.
Oh boy. Okay. Yeah. A little teaser there. I'm excited. All right. Let's start with you. I know there's a lot of crazy things in the world these days, but what is the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
Unfortunately, mine is crypto related. Ethan Allen Furniture, ETH is the symbol, exploded and was up some 50% over the course of 2 days because its symbol looks like it might have been Ethereum. And it's not. Ethan Allen Furniture makes furniture. It's it's a good business with a rising housing market, but it's certainly not as good as the market ascribed it credit for this week. And I thought that was one of the craziest things I've seen.
I love it. I love a good mistaken ticker. Anytime Hewlett Packard reports, I check on the price of Helmerich & Payne, the oil fields company with the ticker HP. I love that. It's amazing. People just are in such a hurry, I guess. They hit those symbols and don't even think about it. That's a good one, Art. Vildana, Art set a high bar with that one. I like that one a lot. I think he beats me. We'll see if he beats you. But as of now, I'm going to just concede that he's in the lead. But mine's pretty good. I'm curious what you think about it, Art. It's this story we had out from Bloomberg by Crystal Kim and Tom Contigliano. And it's about a SPAC that is being formed to raise money to basically buy another SPAC. This is a drug maker called Roivant Sciences, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that. They want to go public with a SPAC to merge with another SPAC and then take over a SPAC acquired by Immunovant, another drug maker that I'm probably mispronouncing. But the point being, a SPAC being formed to basically buy the assets of another SPAC at a huge premium. All right. This kind of makes my head spin, and it goes to your point about how hot those SPACs were for a hot minute there, and then the world came crashing down on them. But how are you looking at the whole SPAC space, and what do you think about a SPAC being formed to buy another SPAC?
Kind of reminds me of the line that they're on double secret probation from Animal House, right? So it feels as though the reason SPACs started to become so popular last year, and there was a record number of them that came out, was because there's so many private companies that were staying private for so long because venture capital money was so cheap. So we had 298 SPACs that came out public last year versus 60 the year before. And then we had 300 in the first quarter of this year. So clearly there's not 500 great ideas for these guys to go by. And I think that supply just swamped the demand for the investors. And it doesn't take much of a hint that some of these things aren't going to work to sort of change the entire attitude towards the group. So again, that was just one of the sectors that lost some of its excess speculative froth in the month of May. And it's probably a healthy thing for all of us.
I think that that issue of supply of shares in the market is so important. You know, this reminded me almost of sort of the dot-com IPO mania on Fast Forward, you know, just overload the market with IPOs and new share supply. And it just, you know, the market just chokes on it eventually.
Right. Absolutely correct. If you went back and looked at the numbers, though, even with the numbers that we saw both in the first quarter of this year and all of last year in SPACs, it doesn't even hold a candle to the number of companies that were coming public in 98, 99.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. All right, Vildana, if I could do a drum roll, I would. But hit us with your craziest thing.
Well, we covered crypto so extensively this week, and obviously so much was happening. I just felt like I needed to take a break from it. But one headline that,
amen,
that caught my attention, it's a Bloomberg headline. It says the hottest property on the market comes with an active volcano. So I'm talking about the real estate market here. And it's an Icelandic family. They own land where a volcano has emerged over the last couple of months. They're getting tons of offers from interested buyers. The Bloomberg story actually has this sentence in it. It says, thousands have flocked to see the eruption. Some have even tempted fate and barbecued hot dogs on the lava. And there's a picture of somebody barbecuing a hot dog on top of this volcano.
That is fantastic. That is, you did. You brought your A game. I love it. Also, I've read that Iceland is a big hotspot, no pun intended, for crypto mining because of all that thermal energy. So my guess is that someone's going to buy that property and put a big Bitcoin mining rig on top of it. That's just my guess.
That's a pretty good guess.
Who knows? Maybe they'll open a hot dog stand with freshly grilled volcano hot dogs. But really good contributions from both of you. I'm going to award a two-place tie for first place in the craziest things. Art, yours was great. Vildana's, yours was good. I clearly need to up my game when I'm around you two. One thing I do want to say is I've been very remiss about giving out the Bloomberg podcast hotline. So if you have a crazy thing you want to share with us, give us a call, leave us a voicemail, and maybe we'll play it on the show. That number is 646-324-3490. And that should do it for this week. Vildana Heirich, Art Hogan, so happy to have both of you on the show. Really enjoyed it. And hopefully we can do it again someday.
Thank you so much.
It's been fun.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heirich is at Vildana Heirich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.